Hello, and welcome to this month's edition of Six Pump Court's Environment Law News Podcast, brought to you in association with LexisNexis. For those of you who listened last month and were expecting the dulcet tones of Christopher Badger, for this edition, you instead have me, Mark Davis, a colleague of Chris's in Chambers. In this podcast, we look at three recent environment law topics. Firstly, the recent Court of Appeal decision concerning civil liability arising from the incursion of the invasive species Japanese knotweed. Secondly, the first enforcement undertaking accepted in a case of odour nuisance. And finally, the reintroduction of the Environment Agency's definition of waste service. The first topic this week is the Court of Appeal decision in the case of Network Rail Infrastructure Limited and Williams and Wastel, in which the court grappled with the question as to what kinds of damage may give rise to a claim in private nuisance. Briefly, the case concerned two neighbouring properties, both of which shared a rear boundary with Network Rail Infrastructure's land. Now, that land was a railway embankment leading down to some tracks. Both properties had been affected by the presence of the highly invasive Japanese knotweed coming from Network Rail's land, and that was accepted as part of the case. Now, the case was brought against the backdrop of a report from the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, RICS, on the dangers of Japanese knotweed. Now, the Council of Mortgage Lenders report set out the difficulty that any applicant would have in seeking a mortgage on a property affected by Japanese knotweed. So much so that if the weed is found within 7 metres of a property's boundary, even after treatment of those affected areas, it is doubtful that that person will be able to secure a mortgage over the property. Now, the recorder at first instance in the case held that both properties had been subject to actual encroachment, but that as neither had suffered any physical damage from the presence of the knotweed, there could be no actionable nuisance in that respect. However, he did find that both properties had been permanently devalued by the presence of the knotweed in respect of sale value, and that such diminution in value was actionable. Damages were awarded in respect of the cost of the eradication of the knotweed, and for a guarantee, as well as for loss of amenity prior to the treatment, and for the loss of value. He did not grant the applicants the injunction they sought requiring a removal of the knotweed. Following that judgment, Network Rail were given leave to appeal, and the Master of the Rolls, Sir Terence Etherton, delivered the leading judgment with the other justices in the Court of Appeal in agreement. Now, the important points to note from that Court of Appeal judgment: firstly, a restatement that the tort of nuisance is, in principle, against property, not people. Secondly, that damage is not necessarily always an essential ingredient of the tort of nuisance, and that the concept of damage for nuisance is a highly elastic and artificial one. Here, in the case of interference with enjoyment or amenity, no physical damage need be shown. Now, in disagreement with the recorder, the Court of Appeal found that damages could not be awarded for the diminution of the property's values. And the basis for that is asserting that any fall in value or market value of those properties and awarding damages for that would extend the tort of nuisance to claims for pure economic loss, and the court, on long-standing principles, simply wasn't willing to do that. However, the final point to note is that the Court of Appeal ruled that the claim could still succeed on the basis of the principle from Leakey. That sets out that absent sufficient damage, the claim could be founded simply on the diminished ability of the claimants to use and enjoy the amenity of their properties. So what I think is apparent from this case is that the Court of Appeal has construed amenity incredibly broadly. Whether Network Rail will be able to argue the matter again before the Supreme Court, both in fact in respect of the definition the Court of Appeal has given to amenity and the highly elastic and artificial concept of damage in nuisance, remains to be seen. Our second topic for today is the recent acceptance of the Environment Agency of an enforcement undertaking following a history of odour complaints. The enforcement undertaking was agreed between Renewi UK Services Limited, which formerly traded as Shanks Waste Management Limited, and the Environment Agency in respect of a site on Sowerby Woods industrial estate, Barrow and Furness. Now there, Shanks operated one of Cumbria's two municipal waste facilities. Local residents around the site had been complaining of the effect of odour since 2014, and those reports had in fact been investigated by the Environment Agency, and the operator had taken steps to minimise the impact of the odour, that being quite important. What I think is important to note from the Environment Agency's own press release on the matter is firstly that they say, where appropriate, it may be in the public interest to accept an enforcement undertaking for an operator rather than prosecuting them for an offence. To those considering drafting enforcement undertaking offerings, recognising that couching such an offer in terms of the public interest may make it more attractive to the regulator. Secondly, the release goes on, enforcement undertakings allow a quicker resolution than a prosecution and help offenders who are prepared to take responsibility for their actions to put things right voluntarily, working with their local environment. So again, for those drafting enforcement offerings, it may be beneficial for the terms to include explicit recognition by the offeror of the issue at hand, again, to make the offer more attractive to the regulator. In the case of Sowerby Woods, the enforcement undertaking offer included an increase in the biofilter stack height and alterations to the management of the processes on site, as well as increased sampling and monitoring, all of which was aimed at reducing, if not eliminating, the odour. In addition to those measures, the operator included a donation of £60,000 to a local environmental charity, made compensation payments to a number of local businesses, and paid the Environment Agency's investigation costs. The upshot of this is, one suspects, that everyone is happy, or at least reasonably happy. The Environment Agency have achieved their goal of protecting human health and the environment, and the operator has avoided the expense of a prosecution and potentially built some goodwill in the community at the same time. Our third and final topic of the day is the reintroduction of the Environment Agency's definition of waste service. At the end of June, the Environment Agency launched its definition of waste service to complement the Is It Waste tool. Now, if the definition of waste service sounds familiar, don't be surprised, it should do. The Environment Agency mothballed a previous incarnation of it back in October of 2016. So by way of recap, since 2014, those involved in the waste industry have been able to use the free Is It Waste tool between the hours of 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Monday to Friday to perform a self-assessment in order to determine whether the material is likely to be waste or not. Now, the tool is based on Article 5 and Article 6, that's byproducts and end of waste, of the Waste Framework Directive, and case law from England and Wales. Although, strictly speaking, insofar as the tool is an Environment Agency function, its use is only in England. Now, however, in addition to the self-assessment function the tool provides, there is also an option to submit a request to the Environment Agency's definition of waste service. Unlike the free tool, the service charges, with an initial interim charge of £750 plus VAT, payable upon submission, and work thereafter charged at £125 per hour plus VAT, in accordance with a cost estimate the Environment Agency's definition of waste service will provide. Insofar as the service will be applying tests derived from case law, it can presumably be safely concluded that the questions asked will be those set out on the relevant guidance page, which draws from that case law. Now, those questions are, has the waste been converted into a distinct and marketable product, meaning, has the waste been turned into a completely new product? For example, a playground surface is produced from waste tires. Is the new product different from the original waste? Minor changes to its composition not being sufficient. For example, non-packaging plastic recycled material is processed to make new plastic products? And is there a genuine market for the material so it will definitely be used? If it's stored indefinitely with little prospect for use, the material will likely remain waste. Questions then go on, is the processed substance or can it be used in exactly the same way as a non-waste? And finally, is the processed substance to be stored and used with no worse environmental effects when compared to the material it is intended to replace? And what I think is interesting here will be to see what the uptake is like for the definition of waste service, particularly amongst small and medium-sized operators who might see the charges as prohibitive. That said, the advantage of having a degree of certainty, particularly some certainty coming from the regulator's mouth, may prove to be money well spent. That concludes this month's Environmental Law podcast. For more information on any of these stories, please do not hesitate to contact Six Pump Court or my colleagues at LexisNexis.